Ave Maria Press has been publishing Catholic books and resources for more than 150 years, and they are located right on the north side of the Notre Dame campus. Visit AveMariaPress.com for a wide selection of spirituality books, classic Catholic literature, and even books for families. You can also find podcasts and free downloadable Catholic content. Visit AveMariaPress.com and receive 25% off your order with code REDEEMER. Ave Maria Press, helping people to know, love, and serve God.
Church Life Today is a production of Spoke Street Media and the McGrath Institute for Church Life at the University of Notre Dame, and is brought to you in part by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union and our listeners.
What you read goes a long way toward shaping the kind of person you become. At the same time, the kind of person you have become goes a long way toward determining how you read what you read, what you think about and how, and the ways in which you interpret the world around you. This mutual shaping of what and how you read and the kind of person you become is fundamental to C.S. Lewis's theory of education, especially but not only in regard to the education of children. His classic philosophical work on education and moral formation is The Abolition of Man. But my guest on this episode also wants to show us how Lewis's understanding of a truly human education forms and animates especially one of his seven Chronicles of Narnia, namely, the Silver Chair. Dr. Rebecca Lamb is a lecturer in theology and the arts at the School of Divinity at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. She is one of the four principal faculty members in the Institute for Theology, Imagination, and the Arts. She is also a contributor to a new volume from Ignatius Press, for which I served as editor. That title is The Chronicles of Transformation, A Spiritual Journey with C.S. Lewis. Dr. Lamb's chapter is called Out of the Shadows, C.S. Lewis and the Idea of Education in the Silver Chair. That chapter is accompanied by six other chapters from other scholars treating the rest of the six Chronicles of Narnia. It's also accompanied by seven original illustrations, seven original poems, and an introductory chapter about arriving at Narnia. This volume is primarily intended for adults and young adult readers to help you rediscover the childlike wonder that is absolutely necessary to enjoy the deep spiritual treasures of these beloved children's stories, which, as it turns out, are not just for children. We first recorded this episode a few years ago when Dr. Lamb visited Notre Dame to give a lecture on the Silver Chair, which served as the basis for her chapter in the Chronicles of Transformation. As for me, I'm Leonard DiLorenzo. This is Church Life Today, a production of the McGrath Institute for Church Life. I'm glad you're here.
Rebecca Lamb, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start out talking about the reason for your visit here to sunny South Bend, Indiana. You came to give a lecture in our series on the Chronicles of Narnia, and specifically on the book, The Silver Chair. So I was wondering if you could start off by telling us a little bit about what appeals to you about these Chronicles, and maybe about this specific book, The Silver Chair.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me to come here.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
It's really exciting to get the chance to look at the Chronicles in a more academic way. But I think also because this is the Lewis Lenten lecture series, you can think about its devotional significance. And, you know, first off, the Chronicles have been part of my life since I was a child. And in fact, I think I was around three when one of my older sisters first discovered the Chronicles and brought them home. And Narnia soon had almost the status of oral tradition, I think, for me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I had some very patient older sisters who would read the stories to me all the time. Lewis actually inspired my love to start reading. I decided that I had to actually, you know, read these stories and not just listen to them. So when I was five, I picked up The Horse and His Boy and I read it in quotation marks. I was very, very resolved. I don't think I understood a lot of it, but I felt, you know, the sense of achievement. Anyway, so from a very early age, the world of Narnia really opened up a sense of wonder for me, I have to say. It shaped so many of the games that I played, my sense of how an adventure should be structured. You know, there has to be peril, but there also has to be beauty and the good will out. So I think those are wonderful things to have inhabiting your environment as a child and shaping your imagination. So anyway, I had a deep excitement when I was invited to come on that for those reasons, those personal reasons. But as a literature scholar who looks particularly at the Victorian period, but also 20th century literature and literary criticism, I think that there's still quite a bit left to be done in terms of examining Lewis's status as literary critic as well as author. So I've also been really interested in looking at his notions of why literature matters. How do we read? What's the purpose of reading? And as I've been exploring the Silver Chair for this Lenten series, it's really opened up a lot of, I think, very valuable avenues for further research on the way Lewis understands the relationship between language and identity and our sense of purpose. So those are some of the things that I've been looking at as I've been preparing to be part of this series.
So in terms of that, like Lewis's writing on stories and storytelling, and as you were saying there, like language and purpose, do you find things or have you found things in him that you aren't finding elsewhere? Is he putting it in a way that seems distinctive among his peers?
Sure. That's a really great question. So the answer is yes and no. Okay. And I think both are really fruitful, actually. Oh, so first of all, yes, I think he's saying some very distinctive things, especially if we think about the context in which he's writing, both the academic context, but also the historical one. While we are, I think, or at least a certain group of people now are very used to the literary theories that Tolkien and Lewis and the members of the Inkling group broadly conceived, developed, the literary theory they developed is rather unique. It was quite important for the recovery of certain practices of literary criticism in the 20th century. Tolkien, for instance, we owe him so much for reviving how we interpret Beowulf, for instance. I would say the same for Lewis, especially in looking at how the romance tradition was understood in the Middle Ages and also in the Renaissance. He got to the point where he also, in his scholarship, contested some of the constructed divides between medieval and Renaissance literature, actually. But when it comes to thinking about some of his contributions to literary criticism, I think one of the things that he was really advocating for in his time period that was quite important was that there is a moral dimension to literary interpretation. This was being contested from a variety of fronts, particularly in the practical criticism school that grew out of the University of Cambridge and was headed by literary critics like F.R. Leavis and I.A. Richards, who had a lot of really valuable things to contribute to the revival of carefully reading texts for, you know, their linguistic significations and so forth. But we're often missing this sense of the ethical implications of how we interpret and read. And indeed, also, they were sidelining the notion that what we read can shape who we are as a person. So one of the many things that Lewis very uniquely advocated for in his specific academic context was that what we read matters and it can profoundly shape us. And of course, that's most clearly expressed in his essay, The Abolition of Man, but it's present elsewhere in many of his writings. So that's one of the unique things that he offered during his time period. Some of the other things that he presented for our reconsideration, I think, was a value of the relationship between the individual person and the literary tradition. And so in doing that, he was advocating for the importance of the literary and even biblical traditions for shaping our sense of meaning in life and value. And in doing that, of course, he is working alongside other thinkers like even T.S. Eliot, even though he didn't like Eliot's poetry. They actually have a lot that...
Nobody's perfect. Lewis is pretty good. But he's not perfect
He's not. I don't understand his issue with The Wasteland. Anyway, that could be a whole other topic.
Right. Yes. We'll have you back.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Redeeming The Wasteland from the clutches of C.S. Lewis.
Right.
How about that?
Exactly. Okay. Oh, I like that. Yeah, that sounds good. So he was not only advocating important ways of interpreting the text that were rather unique, he was also giving a voice to traditional notions of literature as formative that were important. Yeah.
So this moral sense of literature, the moral formation that we're formed, the type of persons we become is formed in many ways by what we read.
Right.
It strikes me that there's another sense of the moral dimension to Lewis, which is that how we read is also formed or not determined, but directed by the kind of person we are.
Yes.
And he brings that in, you know, it seems to me even in the Chronicles, and maybe it's later or earlier, depending on the order you read these, like in The Magician's Nephew, like how you even see or hear the wonders of creation depends on the sort of person you are.
Absolutely.
Right? Does this play into the literary criticism aspect too, the moral formation that goes on before someone even sets their eyes on a text?
Yes, absolutely. absolutely it's involved in Lewis's discussion in literary criticism. So, for example, Lewis argues that we have to learn how to love the things we're supposed to love and hate the things we're supposed to hate, basically. And saying that
we're really good on the second part, right? We hate all the things. We hate all the things.
Yes.
We're not discriminating in our hates.
Right,
maybe we have to become more discriminating.
Yeah, that's very true. And actually, it's really hard sometimes to learn how to love properly and figure out what the orders of love should be. And this became a very particular interest of Lewis in his later writings, for instance, if you think of his work, The Four Loves. This is also a huge preoccupation, not only in the Chronicles, but in Till We Have Faces. But for Lewis, it was very important that you had moral education. So again, to return to the abolition of man, Lewis talks about the fact that an education should teach us how to use our language properly, which in turn helps us to properly identify the moral nature of things. And so moral formation is the fruit of an authentic education that thinks about the whole person. And he gives this really great story of Coleridge going for a walk with two men. This is an abolition man. And they come across a waterfall. And the first man says it's sublime. And the second man says it's pretty. And Coleridge affirms the first man and is quite infuriated at the second.
Because, this sounds like me grading my students' essays.
There you go. Well, yeah. Yes. Well, actually, a big part of our calling as teachers is to help students learn how to properly articulate things, right? And Lewis argues that in this scenario of Coleridge and his two friends going for a walk, Coleridge did not appreciate that the waterfall was not being named properly, because a derivative effect of that is that nature itself is not being read or interpreted properly, right? So the language that we use matters. So that's a big part of what Lewis says is required for an authentic education, learning how to use our speech properly, which is a big challenge in the Silver Chair, for instance, right? The witch is trying to change the order of things through her manipulative speech in order to declare an alternative notion of the world and transvaluate all values, actually. So for Lewis, how we use our language is largely guarded by the kind of moral formation we have or lack thereof.
Very good. You're listening to Church Life Today on Redeemer Radio. We're talking with Dr. Rebecca Lamb, lecturer in theology and the arts at the University of St. Andrews. I think we can probably all imagine the political resonances of that, right?
Yes.
The use and misuse of language to create images of the world, to sort of woo people into a certain camp or another, to close off certain ways of seeing of the world, to force other ways of seeing.
Right, absolutely.
One of the things that I paid attention to in some of what you've written and done is your attentiveness, especially, and we'll stick with Lewis, your attentiveness to the ordinary in the writing of C.S. Lewis. And you had an essay on this, Lewis and George MacDonald, one of his literary mentors, and the role of the ordinary in their fantasy and also in their more straight up essays.
Right.
What have you learned about the ordinary from Lewis?
First of all, that the ordinary is extraordinary, it's extraordinary, right? That the ordinary is actually something profoundly beautiful, but it is a beauty that's almost difficult to bear because it requires our attention and our attentiveness to what we do in our everyday life with regards to how we relate to other people, how we perceive ourselves, how we self-examine and think about what our purpose in daily life is. It's very easy to have a desire for great things or to wish yourself anywhere but where you are.
Right? Yes.
And Lewis and George MacDonald actually as well in their fantasy are constantly using analogies and other worlds to bring us back to the beauty of our world.
To re-enchant the ordinary.
Exactly, right? To re-enchant the ordinary, yes. And to, in a sense, redeem our notions of time and space and what it means to be human and in the world. And of course, in doing that, there are a lot of resonance in both Lewis and MacDonald focusing on that. There are a lot of resonances with also G.K. Chesterton's writings as well, which profoundly influenced Lewis in particular. But for Lewis, it's all the ordinary things of life. Like if, for instance, we look to the Chronicles, it's things like a wardrobe or a railway station or a picture frame that actually become access points to this other world. And this other world, in many senses, further highlights by analogy or similarity or contrast even the realities of our daily experience and the value of them.
And I love that, especially in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Like, yes. He keeps coming back to this point, like, you should never close the door to a wardrobe. It'd be very silly. It's, like, the only thing that Lewis cares about in terms of caring, you know, babysitting children. It's like, just don't close the wardrobe door.
Exactly.
But it seems that part of that reason is because Lucy and the other children are always meant to come back.
Yes.
Right, to re-enchant this world by what they encounter in Narnia.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's a really good point. Yes, they aren't supposed to close off the entry and exit from that world. Mm. Yeah.
Very good. And I brought up the political point because it seems like so much of, especially here in the States, but in Europe as well, like so much of the political discourse is to make us forget about the ordinary.
Yes.
And to woo us, maybe to enchant us in a bad way into the extraordinary. And here, you know, even in the U.S., we're already in a presidential election season a couple of years out, right? So we're always looking to this grand thing and overlooking the ordinary.
Yes.
So maybe this is a little bit of a therapy for all of us, what goes on in this literature.
Yes, I think so. And I think it also can be a very empowering, hopeful thing for us as well to think more carefully about the role of the ordinary, because that is our life 99% of the time, right? And if we take ownership over our daily lives, if we try to commit to living meaningful lives, then the derivative effects of those are, you know, incredibly potent, right? Because so much of the political life really happens in our local lives, right? In the communities in which we live, you know, the people we work with, which we don't always have a say over, for better or for worse, right?
That's right.
You know, learning how to seek out meaningful lives of integrity in the everyday, in our limited circumstances, are, you know, it's really going to be the thing that over the long term sorts out so many of the tensions and anxieties that we kind of conveniently ask the government to try to fix for us, but they can't usually.
And it seems like one of our issues with the ordinary is that we find it boring after a while. But and here, that's a little segue too, because you're a great lover of boredom, a scholar of boredom. Yes. How about that, right? And in particular, for those who don't know, you study the Pre-Raphaelite artists and the poet Christina Rossetti, who attend to the everyday, but also attend to boredom, the importance and the meaning of boredom.
Yes.
What is that? What have you found, and what does this teach us about what it means to be human and perhaps to be Christian, to attend to the boredom?
That's a rich series of questions.
So I just asked you to write a book in about 4 minutes on the air. So go ahead.
I'm currently working on a book on the theological and aesthetic implications of boredom, particularly in the Victorian period, and then with some focus in the final chapter on early 20th century responses to this problem of boredom. So one of the ways I'll approach it for this chat right now is, my interest in boredom really started to develop while I was in graduate school.
Where everybody's submerged in boredom the whole time.
Right? And I was looking at Victorian literature, particularly Charles Dickens, but also the Pre-Raphaelites. And I was also reading a lot of Heidegger at the time.
Oh, gosh.
So it was a really nice mix. In The Fundamental Concept of Metaphysics, Heidegger dedicates over 70 pages to the discussion of boredom as a particularly modern response to the fundamental question of the problem of time. Right? We're human beings. We live in time. We're shaped and constituted by time. He was saying that boredom really announces to us the reality that we are temporally constituted. And he divides boredom into a series of different categories. I won't really talk about that at this time right now. Suffice it to say, boredom really often strips us of our ability to be satisfied with the things around us and can often produce a certain anxiety, can announce to us that time is passing, but our desires are not being fulfilled. And these sorts of affects of discontent, let's say, really started to develop and accelerate during the Victorian period as a result of certain consequences of the Industrial Revolution. Work becomes increasingly and unprecedentedly mechanized, right? You have a switch from a more agrarian sense of the rhythms of time to a very accelerated, fast-paced sense of time. Some of this is very exciting, like the railway lines, for instance, and so forth are great. But it also really caused quite a few workers, especially in, say, industrial cities, a profound anxiety about the fact that their lives were becoming so repetitive, so constituted by work. And alongside that also, many members of the upper class in their diaries record, you know, the sense of the yawning abyss of time, let's say, you know, that they have all this time on their hands and they don't quite know how to deal with it. So Walter Benjamin talks about boredom as this kind of democratic emotion, that regardless of your social or working status, you can feel this problem of boredom weighing on you. And so I was very interested in what this problem is. And in looking through the paintings, the writings, and especially the letters of members of the Pre-Raphaelites, as well as Christina Rossetti, who was very closely linked to the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, I started to see boredom as a particular theme that they're trying to wrestle with, of a particular problem. There are as many solutions to this question of boredom as there are members of the Pre-Raphaelite movement. So for right now, I'll just focus on Christina Rossetti because I think she has the most profound engagement with boredom in her writings and in her art, particularly her poetry. She thinks that boredom can represent a couple different things. It can be a sign of a spiritual problem, so sloth actually, or acedia. And she thinks that sloth is the deadliest of the seven sins because, especially this is her appealing to St. Paul, it prevents you from running your race or having a commitment or a work that you do in life that is meaningful. So on one hand, you can see boredom as, you know, a narcissism, a selfishness, a distaste for the things we owe God, to paraphrase Aquinas, who she definitely looked at with regards to this. But then also boredom, on the other hand, can sometimes just be the natural consequence of living out your daily routines, the fact that daily life doesn't always bring you the things you were hoping for, and that you have to be honest and face that, right? So she also sees boredom as an invitation to spiritual patience, which she thought was a very important virtue, and had this patience for her had eschatological significance as well, because in being patient and being long-suffering and hoping for further meaning, you were in a sense internalizing the attitude of waiting on the Lord, hoping that he will come, right? And so Christina Rossetti suggests that we have to try to conquer boredom, but if it remains with us for certain understandable reasons having to do with just daily life, that we can actually try to sanctify it or offer up these discontented feelings. And in a sense, to make it go full circle, there are some interesting ways Rossetti understands desire that link to Lewis, because he thought a lot about desire and also unfulfilled desire. And on one level, boredom is unfulfilled desire. It's waiting for that which will not give itself to you. And Lewis said that quite a bit of what literature does is it gives us this unfulfilled desire for something beyond what this world can offer us. And so with this unfulfilled desire comes this sign, this hint that we are made for something more, that something is out of joint, and that we can have hopes for heaven, essentially.
You're listening to Church Life Today on Redeemer Radio. We're talking with Dr. Rebecca Lamb, lecturer in theology and the arts at the University of St. Andrew. I love this notion of the invitation to spiritual patience, waiting on the Lord, patience, which is itself a divine attribute, the Lord who is slow to anger and rich in mercy, to actually be transformed into more of the Lord's character. It seems like one of the champions of boredom, of this spiritual patience, is somebody that you had a chance to talk to about a year ago, right? This is the Guinean Cardinal Robert Sarra, who's widely best-selling book, The Power of Silence, really brought this to the fore, the importance of silence, especially in the modern world. He has a new book coming out, The Day Is Now Far Spent, in which he confronts the moral and spiritual crisis of the Western world. But when you talked to him in an interview for the Catholic Herald, it was mostly about the power of silence. What do we have to learn from Cardinal Sarra about silence's power, developing this spirituality of patience?
Right. Oh, I really like that insight of linking patience with silence. I think that that actually is something that clearly comes out in The Power of Silence and in Cardinal Sarra's theology of silence that's certainly been developing in a variety of ways in not only The Power of Silence, but also his, for instance, his autobiography. One of the many things I learned from my interview with His Eminence was the importance of rethinking our relationship to time. And actually, this was modeled in the very interview format with Cardinal Sarra. And, and what I mean is, when I'd ask him a question, there would be this pause.
Oh, boy.
Sometimes rather uncomfortably long pause. And, you know, the first time it happened, I was like, what did I say wrong?
Yeah, you're examining yourself. This is about me. I did something wrong.
Yes, I was all ready for, you know, a filler or to say something more. But I thought, partly because I was, you know, quite in awe of this opportunity, I was like, just give it a little bit. And it was just because he wanted to think seriously about my question and then respond. And so, you know, he didn't, I just realized how quickly we want to fill in silence with noise right away. So anyway, that was one thing that was very interestingly present throughout the whole.
And this is a great thing to talk about on radio, by the way.
Like,
the need to fill. If we had silence right now, everybody would be calling in. So we have to fill the silence.
Right. It's very true. But to continue with that, he was really giving my questions attention. Mm. And I felt respected and affirmed in the way that he was thinking through my questions. So once I got used to that style, it was quite a special exchange. And one of the things that he said that really struck me in this interview was that silence requires a turning inward. And when he said that is easily seen, you know, we can easily think of a turning inward as some sort of egocentric or self-focused mm-hmm. act. But he said, when we turn inward, we are actually searching for the God who knows us better than ourselves and who dwells in our hearts. This is very much an adaptation of, you know, Augustine's God is more interior to me than I am to myself. That was very important to bear in mind. But when he's thinking about our use of time, we have to abide in time and wait, look into our hearts and see what God may be saying to us there. And that requires a great deal of patience because Cardinal Seurat says silence itself is a language, which is a very, I think, strange notion for us in some ways. But what does language do? Language is a system by which we communicate aspects of reality. Right. And so if silence is a language, silence is a system that communicates to us some kind of aspect of reality. And one of the realities that silence reveals to us is the way God operates in time. He operates differently than we think, right? He dwells within. He's not always, you know, meeting some kind of goal on our schedule or you know, finishing up things within a certain set.
He really ought to more often, but I take your point. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He abides in us, right? And so one of the things that I would say is that, you know, God as patient, as loving, as long-suffering, invites us to enter into that same kind of temporal attitude so that we can be with him. Because that was certainly one of the main things Cardinal Seurat was emphasizing, that being in silence means abiding with, being in time with our Lord. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, of course, we can see why the liturgy is especially a mode or an expression of silence. That's what Cardinal Seurat says, which may sound a bit strange, but it's the liturgy is when we keep time with God in a different relation to time itself.
Beautiful. Well, we're about out of time here. Okay. Sorry, there is no other way to say that. No. We're about out of time because we have to keep to a schedule, a radio schedule,
right,
nevertheless. But maybe before we go, if people want to read more about that interview, it's called The Long Way. It was in the Catholic Herald, and you can just search that. It's well worth the read. Mm-hmm. But if you could maybe before we go, just tell us a little bit about the institute where you do your work.
Sure.
The Institute of Theology, Imagination, and the Arts.
Yeah, I'm happy to. So for almost, close to a year now, mm-hmm. I've been based at ITIA, the Institute of Theology, Imagination, and the Arts at the School of Divinity at the University of St. Andrews. And it's getting close to 20 years since the Institute was first founded. And mm-hmm. it was really a flagship initiative that developed at the School of Divinity with some of its faculty members, particularly Trevor Hart, who really wanted to seriously engage with the relationship between theology and the arts and understanding the arts as even extending or further revealing the implications of Christian doctrine, mm-hmm. for example. It really has grown by leaps and bounds. It's inspired so many other spin-off institutes as well in both the States and in the UK. And has really given a very exciting space for thinking about the positive influences of religion on the imagination. And I think this is particularly important for our current time because I really do see an interest, particularly the students I teach, and I've taught at a variety of institutions at this point, that students are really craving a sense of the transcendent and want to examine its purpose. And the arts very often concretely open up to us the transcendent. They make, you know, in a sense, they translate it into flesh, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the very exciting things about this institute is we offer all sorts of initiatives and also programs of study that focus on the ways that we can think more carefully about the nature of God and the reality of God's life in us through the arts. So we have not only a doctoral program, which is an ever-increasingly growing program. We also have an MLIT in Theology and the Arts, which mm-hmm. is quite a popular program as well. And we get students from particularly North America, actually, as well as the UK and elsewhere. We have those two programs. Then we also have a research seminar every week where different faculty from around the world come and give talks on the relationship between theology and the arts. And we also run a program called Transept, where the practice of arts meets theology, which is quite exciting. So it's an application of theological concepts in concrete ways. So those are a couple of the core things that we provide at the Institute. And it's just been such an exciting, dynamic place to work alongside the three other colleagues that make up ITIA. And I'm excited to see where it goes in the future. But it's offered me a space to really examine the things that I care about, which is
quite sounds funny. Like the perfect place in that regard. Yeah. So again, that's the Institute for Theology, Imagination, and the Arts at the University of St. Andrews. You can find that online to learn more. We've been talking with Rebecca Lamb. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for being with us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
If you would like to learn more from Rebecca Lamb, check out her chapter on the Silver Chair in our new volume from Ignatius Press, The Chronicles of Transformation, A Spiritual Journey with C.S. Lewis. Thanks to all of you for joining us on Church Life Today.
Church Life Today is a production of Spoke Street Media and the McGrath Institute for Church Life at the University of Notre Dame, and is brought to you in part by Notre Dame FCU and our listeners.
This show is a production of the Spoke Street Media Podcast Network. For more great podcasts, visit SpokeStreet.com.
Elevate 150 Financial Checkups at Notre Dame Federal Credit Union. Here's how it works. Go online and schedule a 30-minute phone call. They'll guide you through your credit report to find ways to improve your financial health. Then they'll send $150 in your name to Redeemer Radio. For information, visit NotreDameFCU.com/elevate. You already share our values. Why not share in our benefits? Notre Dame FCU.